The song from South Pacific says, "You've got to be taught to hate and fear, to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made or whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be taught to hate all the people your relatives hate." So how can we be taught not to practice bias? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Many companies now have their employees complete diversity, equity, and inclusion training, hoping those workshops will reduce bias in the workplace. But research shows the majority of those training sessions fail. Why do they fail? And what does work to reduce bias? My guest, Dr. William Cox, runs the Stereotyping and Bias Research Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he directs a nonprofit called Inequity Agents of Change, devoted to reducing bias, creating inclusion, and promoting equity by empowering people to become change agents. Will, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's fascinating work that you're doing because it affects all of us every day in so many ways. I'm curious what brought you to the study of bias. I did see something where you wrote about your sister and about yourself right on your website. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit of that background and your own interest in this topic.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So I have a multi-ethnic background. On my mother's side, my mother's Native Hawaiian, Chinese, and Portuguese. And on my father's side, he's a kind of white American mix with some Native American. And so issues of kind of race and cultural identity were always a part of my life growing up. When you look at me and my four siblings, we kind of have a full spectrum of skin color where I have two brothers who are very, very white appearing. Me and one of my brothers are kind of in the middle. And then my sister has very dark skin. And so throughout my life, I'd been exposed to examples of seeing how people treated us differently based on the color of our skin. So racial issues were always a part of my world growing up. And then also I'm a gay man, and my parents are very conservative Christians. And so after I came out to them, it kind of wasn't very pleasant, let's say, and experienced a lot of kind of prejudice related to that from my own family. And eventually was kind of thrown out and was homeless for a while. And so I, throughout my life, had various experiences related to prejudice or biases, discrimination. And as I was in college, I've always had a very scientific sort of approach to things. I was maybe going to be a chemist for a while, but I took a social psychology class and just became fascinated with the fact that we can apply the scientific method to social problems and to understanding people's behavior and how their interactions unfold and so on and so forth. And so then that became my career path to kind of study these sorts of things, why they happen, and then what we can do about them.
I was surprised to see in some of the articles about your work the notion that most of what's being done is failing. You know, there's a lot of effort right now to bring in sensitivity training, diversity training, helping various groups, whether it's teachers or police officers or employees of a company at Starbucks or whatever it is. Lots of effort to have training to tackle the problem of bias in the workplace. Can you talk about what's being done, why there's such a demand for it, and how you came to the conclusion that a lot of it simply isn't working?
So as far as why there's a demand for it, it's because I think people are becoming just more active and aware of the fact that various forms of bias and oppression and systemic and institutional problems exist and are pervasive. And so I think lots of people, employees, managers at companies, you name it, want to do something about it. And so the kind of first approach is like, well, let's pull together some sort of training. The problem then becomes, you know, are those trainings being rigorously assessed? How do we know that they're doing anything? And that's the kind of number one failure that we see out in the world. So someone develops a training. It contains often, most often, very good factual kinds of information, but it's not rigorously assessed in a randomized controlled trial or an experimental design the way that we as scientists try to assess things to demonstrate that they can cause differences in people's behavior. So they kind of don't get assessed at all. So in many cases, we just don't know what their effects are. But when scientists come into these contexts and test these trainings, what the research typically shows is that they kind of do nothing. So people learn stuff in the training, but that doesn't lead to changes in their behavior. It doesn't lead to organizational changes. So it kind of everything just kind of stays the same. Or in many cases, it ends up making problems worse. So training comes in, and if we're talking about maybe implicit bias is a common concept that these trainings will focus on. If we're talking about a racial context, it'll get white folks to understand, oh, there are ways that I could express bias without meaning to, without being fully aware of it. But then they don't really know what to do about that. And so they end up avoiding interacting with people of color, for instance, some of the research shows. And of course, if we have an organization where all the white people are avoiding their colleagues of color or avoiding interacting with clients of color, that ends up creating a more negative climate, not a more positive one.
So that's what you mean by making it worse, that it makes you aware of a problem in such a way that it makes you self-conscious or, reluctant to reach out then because you're afraid of your own bias that you've just discovered is more present than you thought?
Absolutely. That's one of the major ways that these things can go wrong. Researchers have documented many. Another way is sometimes people feel like going through a bias training kind of is the end of the story. So they kind of check a box. Okay, I've done my diversity thing. And then they don't put effort into continuing the work to address these things. And then things can go downhill.
I guess just to push back on that a little bit, I'm thinking of a diversity training, bias training that we had in the department one of the departments where I work on campus. And I found it so eye-opening. And I know it was the factual model where you just have somebody giving you information, and you talk in some of your research about how that puts people in more of a passive role rather than empowering them. But just finding out, for example, that someone who is female is less likely to get called in for a job interview, even if the resume is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The same as if somebody had an African-American sounding name. Adjectives that people use about application essays where if they think it's a woman writing, they might use adjectives like emotional, whereas the exact same application essay, if they thought it was by a man, they might use something like well-crafted or masterful. Just the biases that can come into play when we consider applications for a job or for a scholarship or for a program, I feel like that changed me ever since then, that if I'm looking at a pile of applications, I look carefully that I not be doing that. So, that I look twice if it's something, and you just ask yourself, are you making a judgment based on whether you think that person is male or female or from this race or that race? Are you doing that? Wouldn't just any kind of workshop that gives you information, gives you sort of startling statistics about what's out there with bias, wouldn't that be eye-opening in a way that matters?
I think you're sharing an example that for you was eye-opening, and I think that's wonderful. But the question also becomes, what stage were you at in the kind of journey of being an agent of change when you got that information? And so it's possible you were, a bit further along, more invested in these kinds of issues than the average person. But we have to think about how the training is affecting everyone. Not everyone would have been at the stage where hearing those kinds of things would necessarily turn them on to changing their behavior, as it sounds like happened with you. And the broader issue is, was that training ever assessed in a rigorous way? Did it ever go through a randomized controlled trial, which is the only way we can actually say, hey, this training causes differences. So many of these trainings out in the world, they might have hit on a good model that does lead to change, but without assessing it, we can't really know.
And to measure whether there was any change in the typical workshop that gets held where you're presented information and then you go out the door, if you were trying to measure, did that work, what is it that you would look at? Whether there was change in actual practice of, you know, who gets hired, whether somebody fills out questions that show attitudes towards other people in the same way they would have before. How do you measure that when you're trying to assess whether a practice works or fails?
It can vary widely depending on the specific context. But since you brought up hiring, I can talk about some of our data related to that. In one very large randomized controlled study that we did here at UW-Madison, we were especially concerned about underrepresentation of women in science fields. The research very consistently shows that in many science fields, not all, but in many, the rates of graduating with a PhD for men and women are about 50-50. About half of graduates with PhDs in many science fields are women. But when it comes to who gets hired as tenure-track professors, they're still predominantly men. And so over many years of us doing this study, we had a bunch of STEM departments here at UW-Madison that got our training and a bunch that were randomly assigned to be control groups. And we looked at who got hired as new faculty members. And what the data showed is before our study, so our kind of pre-measurements, in both control and intervention departments, about 32% of their new faculty hires were women. So far short of the 50% you would expect if there's no bias or other kind of inequity in the process disfavoring women. But in the 2 years after our training was administered, the control group was still at about 32% of their new hires being women. But the departments that got our training, their new hires were 47% women. So kind of right up there around the 50-50 mark that you would expect if people are working to eliminate bias from the system. And so that was very encouraging. That's a 43% increase in hiring of women as tenure-track faculty, and that's one of the big outcomes that we were excited to assess in that particular study.
That's amazing. I mean, because that's a significant change.
Yes.
So how does your approach to training differ than the standard one?
So standard kind of approaches, they approach bias trainings using a model that communication scientists call the information deficit model. So there's kind of an assumption like, well, you know, people's behavior doesn't comply with what we want, in this case, having less bias and more inclusion, because there's some sort of deficit. They don't know how bias affects people. They don't know what it's like for a person of color to experience discrimination. And then treats that deficit by giving people information. And what decades and decades of research from the communication sciences field has shown is that that's a very ineffective way to kind of change people's behavior, change people's cognitions. The recipients of that kind of approach find it paternalistic. They feel like people are talking down to them, and so on and so forth. And my colleagues and I, when we developed this approach, with my colleague Trish Devine and Molly Carnes and others here at UW-Madison, we wanted an approach that would kind of meet people where they are. And rather than kind of talking down to them or trying to correct a deficit, we wanted to empower them, to help them better reach their own goals to treat people fairly and to succeed in their positions unencumbered by bias and to be agents of change. And so we approached this from a scientific point of view. We drew on the scientific literature related to cognitive behavioral change and persuasion, intervention science, to craft a message that gets people on board and motivates them to want to do the work, to want to find potential problems in their social environments and then address them.
So isn't cognitive behavioral therapy, the CBT, isn't that something that's standardly used to treat forms of behavioral problems, mental illness, habits? That's kind of a standard approach. So what's different here is that you're taking approach used in one area, you know, different kinds of problems or issues, and applying it to bias.
Yes, absolutely.
Before we get to how you apply it to bias, can you give us an example of how that works as opposed to an information deficit model in another area, not having to do with bias.
So depression would be a good example of this. So you have depression researchers who, you know, run whatever clinical studies, understanding different mechanisms of depression, how depression plays out for people experiencing it, different brain pathways that might be involved, what have you. An information deficit approach, if someone were to use that for depression, would be to kind of give that information directly to people who are depressed. But kind of reading about the kind of academic background, why depression happens and all of that, isn't necessarily going to be the best way to help them kind of overcome their depression. Instead, what a cognitive behavioral therapist does is works with the patient to try to identify things in the patient's life, in the patient's cognitive patterns, help them understand automatic thoughts that pop to mind. Like for many people with depression, they might have automatic thoughts that say, you know, I'm ugly, I'm fat, I'm stupid, people don't like me, those sorts of things. And that can be a significant driver of their clinical depression. And so the therapist works with the client to identify how those kinds of automatic thoughts are impacting them, and then teaches them to autonomously kind of retrain those cognitive patterns to work against those thoughts, gives them cognitive techniques and tools to retrain those cognitive patterns.
So let's take a different example than an example of bias. When I was applying for a job at UW-Madison quite a few decades ago, I ran into gender bias, where I was told, because of being a young woman, oh, you don't look like a professor, or comments about appearance, things like that. So if you were going to, let's say, sitting in front of you at your workshop would be a bunch of men who might have sexist thoughts about women being inferior, or about, you know, just let's say you have a bunch of attitudes towards women that could get in the way of equality, respect in the workplace, that could lead to problems like sexual harassment and other things. How would information deficit model differ from the CBT approach in terms of working with those men that are in your workshop?
That's a great example, and I'm very sorry that happened to you.
But don't
you're
get
not
me
alone.
Started.
I have heard many similar
because I'm a short woman, so I get a lot of stuff.
but you're not alone. I've given this training around all around the country and beyond, I've heard many similar examples. So part of what the training would do related to that example would be to help people to understand, like, well, where do we even get our idea about what a professor looks like, and what's appropriate for appearance of a professor, and talk about the history of that and how our brains absorb that kind of information and lead us to think of professors as being male in this particular example, and typically white males. And actually, some of the specific content we teach, we talk about what's called norm enforcement, which is when people violate what the stereotypical images are of a particular group, so in this case, what a professor looks like. It tends to rub us the wrong way. Our brains don't like when the outside world doesn't match preconceived notions or expectations that our brains have. And so we teach people, look, when someone violates these norms, you're going to feel agitation. Your brain isn't going to like it. And then that often leads to behavior that pushes people to conform to the norms. So, for instance, comments about your appearance would be a wonderful example. Well, sorry, a horrible example that it happened, but a powerful example of this sort of process. So we teach people, look, this is how things could unfold. And if you want to treat people fairly, you want to root out inequities, addressing that is important. And catching yourself when you have those feelings, when you have the urge to kind of correct, quote unquote, someone's appearance in your example.
In some other examples, it's a life and death matter. One of the articles that actually mentioned your work in your lab and that of your colleague Trish Devine looked at a series of experiments at Stanford University. I think this was in the BBC report about it was entitled "Is It Possible to Rid Police Officers of Bias?" Sure. And they looked at a series of experiments at Stanford University where police officers were asked to look at pictures of black and white faces who might be criminals. They were actually all pictures of Stanford University employees. Mm-hmm. They were asked to judge which ones looked criminal. And the results were that not only were they more likely to pick the black faces as more criminal, but that the darker the skin, the more likely they thought the person was criminal. And that leads, as we know, to these brutal murders of unarmed black men, as in the case of George Floyd and so many others, so that sometimes these biases are deadly.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about what you do about that, what are some of the approaches to that, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Wow. This is crazy. I love Boston. This is the second time I've been to Boston in like the past month, and I love it because the first time I went to a place I'd never been before. It's called Southie. Yeah. It's a white ghetto. I've never seen a white ghetto in my life. It was amazing. I saw a white lady steal a bike. And she was wearing a helmet. It was amazing. Coolest thing I ever seen, man.
That's comedian Michael Che. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Will Cox, and we are talking about reducing bias. Will, in that clip where Michael Che is doing stand-up comedy in Boston, and he gets these laughs about the idea of sort of a white woman stealing a bike, can you explain why the audience is laughing about that? And how it relates to what we were just talking about in terms of the deadly nature of bias when it's on the police force.
So a large component of humor is kind of subverting but then matching expectations. So getting an audience to anticipate what the punchline, for instance, of a joke is going to be. And stereotypes are culturally shared expectations. And so for many comedians, they're kind of ripe for making people laugh because they can draw on kind of culturally shared knowledge about social stereotypes to then have a punchline that maybe subverts or matches the stereotype in different ways. And so in the case of that particular joke or story, you know, it's the expectation that a white lady isn't going to be a criminal. And then she was. So it's subverting that sort of expectation that makes it funny. It interacts with how our brain's reward system works in terms of anticipation and prediction and then reward, which is what kind of feels good. So we find that stereotypes very often are perpetuated through humor. They're kind of an easy way to build jokes. And that's actually a lot of what my lab has studied, looking at how these stereotypes spread through culture, through internet memes, through comedians. We actually have a large study that's getting going this fall where we're looking at how comedians making jokes about stereotypes related to their own group, such as in the clip you just shared, are probably likely to spread stereotypes more than when someone outside that group uses stereotypes, which people tend to find more offensive. So people tend to think if you're a member of the group, you're allowed to make those jokes, and that it's not offensive when that person does it. But the net effect is going to be perpetuating those stereotypes even more because other people hearing the joke will think, oh, that's okay. This person who's in that group believes the stereotype.
I've heard a lot of that kind of humor where it might be a Jewish comedian making fun of the Jewish mother, you know, who boasts about her son, the doctor, and serves chicken soup. Or it might be someone who is an Asian comedian making fun of stereotypes there or black comedians making fun of black culture. And you're saying that almost has a worse effect because it makes it seem like it's okay to practice those stereotypes if it's something that the person from that group is laughing at?
Or makes it seem like the stereotype's more true. So many stereotypes are not accurate, not true when they get kind of systematically assessed. But people often believe they're more accurate than they actually are. And so when it's a member of the group saying, oh, people like me are like this, it is more likely to let people – well, if – for people in the audience to say, well, he says it's true. He thinks that's funny. He would know his group better than I would. And so it leads people to believe those stereotypes more.
There seems to be such a long tradition of jokes at the expense of one ethnic group or one culture or another, you know, picking a group and making fun of them that way. But I hadn't really thought about the overall effect of humor in perpetuating the stereotypes. Because we do laugh, and maybe that laugh is sort of in part discomfort.
It can be. You know, of course it's going to depend on the joke. But it's also just related to how our brain works, how a combination of words and expectations kind of comes together in a really interesting sort of way that our brain then finds to be humorous. One thing I suggest to people, often if someone finds a joke to be offensive, their response is something along the lines, well, that's not funny, because what they're trying to say is that's offensive. But if someone's telling the joke and they find it amusing, you know, it's funny to them, and something can be funny and also offensive. So I often encourage people not to have the reaction of saying, oh, that's not funny. Say, that's offensive, or, you know, that perpetuates a negative stereotype that I'd rather not have in my mind.
So back to the serious question of police officers.
Yes.
And whether anything can be done to reduce bias that can otherwise be deadly, that if you have stereotypes, prejudices, biases against people based on the color of their skin, that can translate into a quickness to use deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
What have your studies shown about why that exists there in the first place as bias, and what doesn't work and what might?
Yeah, so this was actually some of my very first research many years ago. I worked with the term for what you're describing is called shooter bias, kind of the tendency to be quicker to shoot a black suspect compared to a white suspect. So to answer your question about kind of where that comes from, well, associations stereotypes that associate black folks with criminality and violence are some of the most widespread and pervasive stereotypes out there. We see evidence of kids as young as 5 and 6 already kind of knowing those predominant stereotypes, thinking that black folks are criminal or violent. So we all learn those things from a very young age. And then the other part of your question, well, what can we do about it, and how would our training approach affect those sorts of things? That's actually a core part of what we talk about. And when I do this training with police officers, which I have on many occasions, I really focus in on this. So for those kinds of automatic biases, like things that are going to affect you in a split second sort of decision, really the work has to come before. So working on these kinds of mental habits, these stereotypes, it's not something that you can just erase from your brain by going to a training, for instance. It's something that our training can teach you how to retrain those automatic reactions over time, working at it bit by bit. Again, similar to the depression example that we had earlier. A depressed person, you know, they don't go to the therapist, and the therapist doesn't say, you know, oh, well, just change the way you think about yourself, and then that's it. It's teaching people the tools to work and build different cognitive patterns. And that's part of what our training does, helps people to build patterns that associate black folks less with criminality, in your specific example.
Give me an example, a concrete example of how you would do that. So let's say you have a police officer who is more likely to think the darker the skin, the more criminal the person is likely to be. Let's say that is there, and you've proven that biases in their head. What would be some of the tools you'd use?
Sure. So working on alternate kind of, it's called stereotype replacement. So we encourage people to take a few steps that are involved in retraining reactions. And those steps are kind of detect, reflect, and reject. That's our little mnemonic device. So you have to detect when stereotypes pop to mind, detect the association that you have associating black folks with crime in this particular case. And then rather than just letting that automatic thought kind of pass by, as we often do, you want to kind of stop and reflect on it, kind of bring in your more rational, cognitive, effortful processing to think, gosh, why did I have that automatic impression that this black person maybe was dangerous, you know? And you can think back to how you've learned those sorts of associations through the media and through your social environments. Also think about what some of the negative effects of that automatic gut reaction are. So for instance, the research that you mentioned, where we know these sorts of things can contribute to the murder of young black men by police. So kind of bringing in those emotional things and then mentally rejecting that notion and work on rehearsing something else. So getting more exposure to black folks that buck that stereotype.
In that same BBC article that talks about the police officers, the one that's called, Is It Possible to Rid Police Officers of Bias? You're quoted as saying, we found that for every one person who confirms a bias, it takes three to disconfirm a stereotype to balance it out. And you're talking in particular about how if you see a black student on campus and you assume, oh, it must be a basketball player, you would need to encounter three students who are not basketball players and are black in order to counter that. Why is it such a disproportionate thing where you have a stereotype and then you need triple the amount of the opposite to get rid of it?
Yeah. So that comes out of a lot of our research on confirmation bias is kind of the broader term. Part of what this is our brains learn these stereotypes and they become habits of mind. And part of the definition of a habit is that it's hard to change. Our brains don't want to let go of habits of cognitive patterns that have been well learned over many years. If our brains have a more efficient way of thinking about people or making judgments, our brains want to keep that efficiency rather than kind of use the literal energy it requires to rewire neural connections and so on to change those things. And so our brains tend to favor information that's confirming our expectations and assumptions, confirming the stereotypes in this case.
So when we're looking at stereotypes, is it sometimes a little bit tricky to figure out what is definite bias that needs to be gotten rid of and what is to some extent common sense? I'll give you an example. My mother used to tell me when I was little, if you need help from a stranger, find someone who looks like a grandma. You know, a grandma's going to be safer. You know, find someone who looks like a grandma and go to that person. Now, is that bias or is it common sense? Because if you look at the statistics, she probably is correct that someone who looks like a grandma is going to be less likely to be a predator, to be a problem for a young child.
I'd say it can be both. So, I mean, by a very strict academic definition of bias, I mean, it's judging someone based on their appearance and so on and so forth. And surely not everyone who looks like a grandma is going to be very helpful. Where this intersects with what we do in our training approach is just ask the question, you know, is that a bias that causes harm? And think about what the negative effects of it could be. And I don't think a lot of people would worry about that particular bias. I could be wrong. I'd have to think about it more, maybe. But when the biases relate to, so sticking with the same social group, assumptions that an older woman isn't going to be good at technology or won't be suited to a job, that's something that has a negative impact that we might want to work against. And that's crucial to our approach, which is giving people their autonomy to be thoughtful about those kinds of decisions themselves and what they work on, rather than dictating it like those information deficit model approaches more often do.
Well, we see it come up with who gets pulled aside for extra screening at an airport, you know, and to what extent is it reasonable to assume some people are at a higher risk? It's a kind of a tricky area. Or here's another example for you. This is a pandemic example. Sure. Let's say I'm in my office and I have two different people who come in the office and we're not supposed to ask, are you vaccinated? Because that violates their privacy. Mm-hmm. Let's say you know that a community of color in particular is much less likely to be vaccinated. That's just the statistical, you know, data that's out there. If you reach for a mask when you see someone from that community coming into your office and you don't do that if it's someone that is not from that community of color, is that a bias that is reasonable because you're protecting your health, or is it really dangerous because you're treating someone like a leper?
I side on the dangerous side, but also because the person who isn't from a community of color, their appearance isn't necessarily a good indicator of whether they're vaccinated or not. So you're also leaving yourself open in that case. Although there might be trends, like I don't actually know these particular statistics that you're talking about, but although there might be trends where people of color might be less likely overall to be vaccinated, when you're dealing with one person in front of you, those statistics aren't necessarily diagnostic. And skin color, race, isn't going to be the most diagnostic thing in the moment. And so what I would encourage people to do is to have a policy that's applied equally across different folks.
I guess what I'm getting at is every day there's a whole lot of different ways that we're making decisions or reacting and to people's appearance, to what we think about them. In your own case, what have you been surprised to kind of notice about your own practices where you've had to kind of put your own lessons into effect or rethink something?
Oh, gosh. I've been doing this for so many years. I'd have to think back. I have an example that I think dovetails nicely with the one that you just shared. So this wasn't for me, but this was from an attendee at one of these trainings. So I administered the training for a university housing department at another university, not ours. One of the attendees recognized a bias that had been happening in their dorms. So the way their dorms were set up, the residents, the students living in the dorms, they could buzz people in who were bringing deliveries, like food deliveries or whatever. So they could either buzz people in and the person would come all the way to their dorm room, or have them wait in the little lobby area, and then the student would come down to get their deliveries. And the resident assistants had been noticing for a while that people were more likely to buzz white delivery people up to their rooms and were more likely to make black delivery people stay in the waiting room. And this is something that they had a big conversation about. They were like, well, this year's safety, right? So if people are feeling unsafe, we don't want that. But if the feeling of unsafety is coming from skin color, that's not something that we want to support. And the discussion ended up becoming like, well, we need a better policy about this. We shouldn't let it just kind of be by the seat of our pants. And so what they ended up deciding was that actually it's not safe for anyone to be coming up to the dorm rooms, because anyone could be criminal or violent or what have you. And so they decided, you know, actually all delivery people from now on should stay in the lobby because that's what maximizes safety. And then we're not letting the students' biases affect how people get treated depending on race.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's just a good example of how this comes up in sometimes subtle, sometimes blatant ways, for sure.
Yeah.
You mentioned in some of the work that you do that bias, it can fit, you know, it can apply to so many different things. It can be bias against someone who is overweight. It can be bias, you know, based on height. It can be bias in about speech. All kinds of ways that we judge people. What is your own kind of working definition of the term bias?
I'd say it's treating someone differently based on their social group status.
So social group status, for example, you know, in an article in the Atlantic that also mentions your work called Is This How Discrimination Ends? It talks about teachers who mm-hmm. are more likely to assume that an obese child is less intelligent than a slim child, and that if it's a black student in their classroom, they're more likely to get punished.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's by different social group. If it's something where it has to do with obesity or height, we know that tall men generally earn more and are more likely to be looked up to. You know, if it's something like that where it's based simply on an appearance, is it it's sort of different than a social group, isn't it?
It's different in terms of, you know, there probably aren't a lot of clubs for tall people, or in terms of like the social reality, you know, I don't know the extent to which tall people, you know, group together in that way. But in terms of your perception, in terms of in your mind, you know, tall people can be a social group, or tall men, specifically for some of the statistics you're talking about.
Well,
but
the
net
same
effect is the assumption that comes up, or the treatment of the individual. And then it's up to the person who's making those assumptions to recognize, hey, this is a bias I don't want to have. This is something I want to work against. And people are very willing and able and motivated to do that kind of work and address those kinds of things, so that they're treating people based on their merit rather than by assumptions.
We're going to talk about how bias can show up with effects in the healthcare system and in many other places when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Studies demonstrate bias across nearly every field and for nearly every group of people. If you're Latino, you'll get less pain medication than a white patient. If you're an elderly woman, you'll receive fewer life-saving interventions than an elderly man. That's from an article in The Atlantic called Is This How Discrimination Ends? I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Will Cox, and we are talking about his groundbreaking work in what can be done to end bias, or to at least reduce it. Will, let's talk about medical situation and the way that bias can lead to actual fatalities sometimes, yep, or definitely less care.
Oh, absolutely. The statistic you mentioned about older women versus older men, very often symptoms of heart attacks aren't recognized as readily in women. In fact, I have a dear friend whose mother passed away from a heart attack in the last year, and it seemed to be one of those cases, which was very upsetting, where we think the doctor didn't recognize the signs of a heart attack in her mother. Yes, these kinds of biases, they can infect. We're all vulnerable to them influencing our judgments, and every field involves some kind of judgments. And yes, in the medical field especially, they can be life or death. Some colleagues of mine, we're doing a study where we're assessing this training among doctors, and they shared this example as one of the things that kind of got them interested in the topic of bias in medicine. So they're in Canada, where one of the bigger forms of bias that Canadian folks deal with is towards Indigenous people. And one of the assumptions that they make related to Indigenous people is that they're going to be more likely to be alcoholic. This colleague of mine was with her sister, her sister was having a stroke, and she brought her sister into the emergency room, the triage folks saw that this woman was kind of slurring her speech, not able to stand up, and kind of immediately signaled, and she was getting carted off to go to the drunk tank, because they made the quick assumption, oh, this is a drunk Indigenous woman. And luckily, this woman was with her sister, who was a medical professional, who said, no, she actually doesn't drink. She never drinks. She's completely sober. She's having a stroke, and was able to get it addressed properly. But if her sister hadn't been there, that quick assumption that, oh, she's probably drunk, would have put her in the drunk tank where she wouldn't have gotten treated for the stroke appropriately, and it potentially would have done more damage to her health, to her brain, and so on.
Yeah, that's a shocking example. In the one I gave from the Atlantic article where it talked about getting less pain medication if you were Latino, why would that be?
So there are kind of two major mechanisms people talk about. So one is sometimes less compassion, perhaps, if we're talking about a white doctor with someone who's a Latino or a Latin descended person. They might just not empathize with the pain as much, not think the pain's as severe, and so not give as much or any pain medication. The other potential mechanism is assumptions that the person is drug seeking or a drug user. There are lots of stereotypes that say that Latin American folks are more likely to be illegal drug users.
I think in general, women find that they're taken less seriously when they go into the healthcare system. And if you look at it going back a long time ago with that term hysterical and the root of that linked to the uterus, you know, that if a woman complains of something, she's likely to be called crazy or emotional or something like that. So the medical area has a long history of confronting bias, does it not?
Well, it has a long history of bias occurring. confronting it, mixed history on that. But I think that our modern medical folks are much more aware of these sorts of things and trying to address them. Absolutely.
I guess I'm trying to think about what can actually happen on a very practical level to change one's mindset. It is, as you pointed out, where you need, you know, three examples on the other side to counter one thing that you hold kind of firmly in your head. And I'm thinking about the poet William Blake, who said, "The man who never alters his opinion is like standing water and breeds reptiles of the mind." You know, if you don't change your mind, it's really bad, but it's, you know, people are very entrenched sometimes. These ideas are entrenched.
Sure.
So can you give me an example from your work of a situation that might have seemed hopeless, where nothing is going to change that person's mind or practice, you know, and what could be, what something, I'm trying to get a concrete sense of the tools you're using and why they work.
Oh, yeah, I could share an example related to one of the tools. I don't know that it was a hopeless situation to start with because it actually has to do with me. Yeah, so one of the tools we talk about, one of the key tools is doing perspective taking. This is something that a lot of people in the public arena talk about because there actually has been a lot of research behind it. So my example of perspective taking, it, how it kind of really changed my behavior. So I was giving this training along with my wonderful colleague Trish Devine at a large university out west. And the training went very well, you know, and afterwards people were staying to kind of have additional discussion and kind of pick our brains about different things. And as we were having additional discussion, there was a woman in the very back of the room who raised her hand. And she was sitting in a wheelchair behind all the rows of chairs. And she drew our attention to that fact and said, you know, did anyone else notice that the way this room had been set up by their utilities folks wasn't set up to meet basic ADA requirements? Honestly, I hadn't noticed that. If you had asked me what ADA requirements are to make sure rooms can be set up a certain way, I probably could have cognitively told you. I probably knew what the general rules are about how aisles have to be a certain width. You have to have a certain section where someone can pull up in a wheelchair and actually be sitting next to their colleagues and so on and so forth. But I hadn't noticed that the room was set up incorrectly. And this afforded me a really natural opportunity to do perspective taking, to practice what I preach, if you will. And so when I was back in my hotel that night, I did perspective taking. I was like, gosh, what was it like for that woman to come to this session, which was about inclusion, about diversity, about making positive climates where everyone can thrive? And then how did it feel to be physically excluded? She had to sit behind everyone. She couldn't chit-chat with her colleagues, you know, when we had breaks and so on. And it made me emotional. I mean, I always get emotional telling the story, actually. It doesn't feel good to be excluded. And I had a lot of empathy for her kind of experience. And one of the nice things about this perspective-taking tool is that sort of empathy, that emotional connection to the experience of someone else. It leaves a mark on you and serves to help motivate you to keep working on these kinds of issues. And in this case, that's what happened. Since that day, I'm unable to walk into a room without looking around and saying, okay, if someone comes in a wheelchair, if someone comes with some sort of walking assistive device, where are they being fully excluded? How is this room going to be accommodating to them? And it's an inevitability for me. I can't walk into a room without thinking that because of that emotional connection and that mark it left on me. And so as I go throughout my daily life, whether I'm the one presenting in a room or if I'm just an attendee at something, I look around. I think it would shock a lot of people how often rooms are not accommodating. But I do the work and carry it forward because I applied one of these tools and it left that kind of mark on me.
That's a great example. I did notice in some of the write-ups about your work that one of the signs of success from people who complete workshops can be putting things into action, speaking up, you know, not just changing their own views, but also, like you, looking around at other places and then taking that next step of maybe saying, hey, this isn't right. Let's change it. You talk about agents of change and empowering people. What does success look like for you if you've completed a workshop? What do the people in that workshop, whether it's police officers or public school teachers, healthcare professionals, what do they go back into their lives and do?
So this might be a little abstract at first, but I promise I'll make it more concrete. But when they kind of first are leaving the training, my biggest hope is that they're motivated to make these kinds of changes, and they see it as the start of a journey rather than, oh, well, this training session's finished, so I'm done now. Because so much of what we do is instilling in people that it is going to be work. It is going to be something that you have to stick with and put in effort over time to make changes, both within your own behavior and in the world around you. And what we've seen is that people do that work. So a lot of the tools we teach them are about these kind of mental retraining things, like I've discussed a bit. And we see that they do that. And we actually, down the road, they have lower levels of kind of automatically activated biases or implicit bias because they've worked on kind of retraining those cognitive patterns. We see, as you mentioned, that they speak up more. So in a few studies now, we've seen that so one of our studies was with students here at UW-Madison, and they were twice as likely to speak up in a classroom context about bias and inclusion related topics in our study, which was really exciting. And they were speaking up about specific topics that we hadn't taught them about in the training. So, you know, a training, it's a limited amount of time. We can only cover so many types of bias, but we encourage people to take what they've learned and apply it to other types of bias. And that's how we set up this study. So in this particular study, this version of the training, it didn't talk about gender identity or trans or non-binary gender-related issues. But in this classroom discussion we set up, those issues were part of the discussion. We were hoping that people who had our training would apply what they learned into that new context, that new type of bias. And in fact, they did. And that was very exciting. They were autonomously applying what they learned and generalizing it and customizing it to new venues.
So I guess the conclusion would be that if you learn to change your perspective, to empathize, to question things, you can apply that then to many different aspects of your life, not just the ones that showed up in a workshop.
Absolutely. And humility also is an important part of that. You can be humble enough to say, you know, I might not understand someone else's perspectives, especially someone coming from a different identity than myself. And so why don't I listen more to what they have to say?
And maybe humble enough to say, I know I have biases. I just need to figure out what they are and what to do about it. Because I think it's scary when you hear people say, oh, I'm not biased, because I think we all are. We just have to work on figuring out what those biases are and what to do about them. I thank you for the work that you're doing and for being on the air with me. My guest has been Dr. Will Cox, and his work is on reducing bias. We're going to go out on a James Taylor setting of the You've Got to Be Carefully Taught song from South Pacific. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully